OMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Pandora, Modular, streaming royalties and George Osborne. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. As ever, I have with me Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
Hi. I haven't written down anything to talk about in this slot this week.
Are you saying that if you don't pre-script our conversations, we're not able to talk to each other?
As you know, that is true of on podcast and off.
Of life. I'm a bit depressed this week.
Are you?
Because on the tweets, I follow Twitter.
Yes.
I'm very modern like that.
Yes.
On Twitter, someone said they chuckled 4 times on last week's podcast, which is one down on the previous week. Because was it not 5 previous week?
That is true. We're losing chuckles.
So last week we went to all our effort to have more chuckles during the podcast, and we had one less, despite having all of Justin Bieber's classic ridiculous quotes from that magazine.
That's true, but the chuckles were probably all loaded in there, because, I mean, the rest of it was quite dry, wasn't it?
So I'm wondering whether we should bring back the pop joke corner that we used to do in the old CMU Weekly email that we don't do anymore. Because that was always full of huge hilarity, that little joke at the end of every edition.
Just classic jokes with Robbie Williams inserted into them.
Robbie Williams was always the punchline. Yeah, come to think of it, that wasn't very funny.
What's the difference between Robbie Williams and a bison?
Robbie Williams.
Well, no, you can't wash your hands in Robbie Williams.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah, I think we've just proved that actually that's not going to increase.
We could bring back the Where Are They Now.
We could bring back Where Are They Now. Or we could do what we generally do in the CMU Daily to make our readers chuckle, which is misplaced inappropriate swearing.
Yes.
So perhaps that's something that doesn't require us either digging through the archives or coming up with some original gags. We just have to swear a bit.
So any point you feel like there's a lull this week, you just swear randomly.
Well, it has to be inappropriate, so it has to be in the middle of us talking about something very weighty and serious.
Okay.
So we'll find an opportunity for that on this edition
of the
podcast. I'll
get the explicit tag ready for iTunes.
Yes. Yes, we don't want any iTunes, what are they called? iTunes downloaders who don't like swearing in their podcast to end up having to listen to our podcast. So we'll see how it goes.
Let's see.
This is my plan. So I'm aiming for, well, at least back up to 5 chuckles. I don't want to be over ambitious. Not necessarily going up to 6 this week, but maybe back up to the 5 for this week.
Okay. I mean, we'll try to give you some important music business information, but I mean, that's probably less important.
It's less important.
Well, let's see how we get on with Pandora first, shall we?
Well, I mean, some of the quotes in this story I thought were quite amusing.
That's true.
Over the top press release of the week goes to Pandora.
Yes.
With their purchase of Ticketfly.
Yes, Ticketfly, which is a US-based ticketing company, which you probably could have guessed from its name. Pandora has bought it for $450 million. The company was launched in 2008 by one of the founders of Ticketweb, Andrew Dreskin.
Yes, Ticketweb obviously is now sort of the grassroots ticketing bit of Ticketmaster.
Yep.
He founded that, then Ticketmaster bought it, he got out of that, and then he set up Ticketfly. And assuming you're listening to this in the UK, which is a rash assumption, because we definitely have a listener who's not in the UK.
We have several listeners who aren't in the UK.
But if you are in the UK, you've probably never heard of Ticketfly, but that's because they are predominantly based in America and Canada. They do represent quite a lot of tours and venues in North America.
I met some people from Ticketfly at Canadian Music Week.
Oh,
this year.
Did you?
Yeah, they were quite nice.
So there you go. So yes, $450 million, it's a lot of money. Given that Pandora is busy trying to cut what it has to pay to record companies and publishers and artists and songwriters, and as we will talk about in a minute, in some ways, that's partly behind this acquisition, although you can't help thinking that all those artists and songwriters are going to be saying, well, you can find $450 million when you want to buy a random ticketing company, but you can't afford to pay us to play our music.
Yeah, but this is an important deal.
It is. It is. It's a game-changing deal.
It is a game-changing deal. So says Pandora CEO Brian McAndrews, anyway.
This is a game changer for Pandora, and much more importantly than that, he said, it's a game changer for the music industry.
He just said for music, didn't he? Yes. More broadly than that.
It's a game changer for music. Yeah,
all albums are now going to sound different.
As now this deal has been done, songs won't rhyme anymore. and things will be at, will be in, everything will be in a different key than it used to be.
It's a bit of, been a bit of a week for this, isn't it? It's like Rihanna unveiled the artwork for her new album and said it was or something. What was it? Did she say like a monumental a moment in the history of album artwork? Because it's the first time that Braille had ever been used in album artwork, even though that is definitely not true.
On what do you base that accusation? I let it go in the CME Daily without even questioning your judgment, but you reckoned not only was it not the first, you reckon it's been done loads of times before.
I have seen with my eyes albums with Braille on the front of them. That is, there's not a new thing. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about.
It's not what we're talking about.
What we're talking about is this game-changing Pandora deal.
It's a game-changer, everybody. So whatever game you were playing, you now have to change. So I was playing Solitaire, and now I'm playing Tetris. So there you go. That's how I have reacted to this game-changing moment in the music industry. So I suppose because of the hype, because of the ridiculous press release, my instinct is to then be very dismissive of this deal and say, what a load of nonsense. But that said, we have all been saying for a number of years now that the streaming services, as they build bigger and bigger audiences, should get better at integrating their platforms with all of the other platforms online where artists are either marketing themselves or selling products.
Yes.
And we've seen other streaming services do this. So Spotify, back in the day, sold downloads.
It did.
And then they sort of went for merch, although in the same way that the download upsells seem to die a death, are they still linking through to people's merch
stores? Yeah, if you go to an artist profile, you'll get, if the artist has set it up, you get links to go off. I mean, it will link you to another site.
Yes.
But you can technically buy merch. Merch is certainly listed for sale on Spotify. And the same is, I mean, like gig tickets are listed for sale. If you go on, they've got a Songkick integration so that if you go onto an artist profile, I did it this morning with one of the approved artists who we'll discuss later. They're playing a gig this week in London. It came up on their artist page saying this band's playing a gig in London this Friday.
And so it makes sense on all kinds of levels that they should be integrating with all of these other platforms. A, it makes it a more user-friendly experience. B, potentially, I mean, actually, in most cases, I think where Spotify is integrated, it's not a revenue stream for them. They're not asking for a cut of any of the revenue. It's just as an artist, you can go in or it pulls in the content from, as you say, from Songkick or another service like that. And it's not looking to make any money. But, you know, potentially there is revenue potential there. You know, these services could be taking a share in some of that money. So it gives streaming services, none of which are making any money, perhaps the opportunity to diversify their revenue streams. And also, it's a way of placating artists. So those artists who are down on streaming or who moan about the monies that they're receiving or they don't think the royalties that the streaming services, whether it's Pandora or Spotify, are paying is enough. Well, it's a way of saying, okay, well, we're helping you market yourselves. We're helping you promote yourselves. And that is what streaming services often say, particularly Pandora. And I suppose if they then have the upsell, so there are buttons and there are links that actually help artists turn that interest into a revenue stream or even just, you know, an email address into a direct-to-fan platform, then that is bringing value beyond the royalties that are being paid. So I suspect that this deal is twofold for Pandora. It is actually to diversify their revenue streams because at the moment they're a predominantly advertising-funded business.
Yes.
Obviously, Pandora is only available in the US and I think Australia and New Zealand, but predominantly the US, and it's an ad-funded business. There is a subscription service, but the vast, vast, vast majority of the 80 million people who are signed up to Pandora, remember how... Whenever I say that to people in the music industry, they're always shocked. Bearing in mind Pandora only really is available in one country, how the fact it is more people signed up and actually Spotify may well now be at 80 million. But it is, you know, the biggest streaming service other than YouTube and SoundCloud, which... And it only operates in one country.
Yes.
And people find that surprising. And it's a way of diversifying the revenue because the ad income isn't really bringing in enough money, certainly, you know, for Pandora to become a truly profitable business. But we do know that artists and songwriters and labels and publishers are very down on Pandora because unlike Spotify, that has direct relationships with the labels and the publishers and sometimes the collecting societies, Pandora licenses everything through, on the recording side through a compulsory license through Sound Exchange. On the publishing side, they forced it through the collective licensing system, even though some of the publishers don't want it to go through the collective licensing system. So whereas over here, some artists and songwriters are down on Spotify, but generally the labels and publishers are quite pro-Spotify, in the US, everybody in the music community hates Pandora.
Yes, and well, there's various reasons for that, but mainly it's they feel that Pandora isn't paying them enough, and then Pandora is not helping that debate by trying to get the US government to allow them to pay even less.
Yes, so on the sound recording side, as I said, they license through Sound Exchange. That's all governed by a thing called a compulsory license. The Copyright Royalty Board decides what they pay. And so Pandora are busy at the moment lobbying the Copyright Royalty Board, saying, we should pay less, we should pay less, we should pay less. At the same time, the labels are saying, no, you should pay more, you should pay more. And the same is basically happening on the publishing side too. So Pandora has a lot of enemies in the American music industry. And I suppose this is a way of placating, well, who? Placating who? I mean, not really placating labels, because in the main, labels don't earn when tickets are sold. They might do through a sort of, you know, multi-revenue stream deal, but as a general rule, record companies don't really care if tickets get sold.
Yeah, and not songwriters, because songwriters, and you know, if you're just solely a songwriter, you're not touring.
No.
So you earn no money off that.
So, well, I suppose as a songwriter,
I mean, in other words, publishing income, but
you do get your royalties from ticket sales. But in the main, songwriters don't like it when you say to them, "Well, go on tour and sell T-shirts." Okay, if you jobbing songwriters don't like that line, so
try saying it to one this afternoon.
Yes, and you will discover they don't appreciate it.
Really it. Upsets them.
So, artists might be placated by this. Other people in the music industry will be like, "Well, that's great for you, Pandora. It's great for you, Mr. Artist, but what do we get out of it? Nothing." And also, I suppose, by actually buying a ticketing company and therefore becoming a ticketing agency, rather than having reciprocal deals with Ticketmaster and all of the other ticketing companies, there are plenty of artists who will be working with promoters who will say, well, we don't want to work with Ticketfly. You know, we want to work with whoever it is that we work with already. Anybody touring with Live Nation or managed by Live Nation is probably going to want to still work with Live Nation's yeah. Ticketmaster. So it'll be interesting to see in terms of what we assume will happen is that Pandora have already been expanding their data services for artists. So they have their artist platform. That's not what it's called. It's got a name.
It does.
Does it work out like AMP or something as an acronym? Anyway, they've got their data platform for artists. Obviously, they bought Next Big Sound, so they've got another data side to the business. And so we assume that Ticketfly and all of that will be lumped together so that artists will be able to go into the system and see, okay, this is where we have fans. These are the people who are listening to our content. Now we can start sending alerts or emails or letting those people know that we're touring, trying to sell them tickets. But if, as a promoter, you don't want to sell your tickets through Ticketfly, will you be prevented from having that extra marketing and data benefit?
Yeah, that could be an issue. But then I suppose to be more positive about the potential for this, or maybe just a potential for this sort of thing in general, and I think live work is probably one of the more obvious integrations into streaming, rather than, you know, upselling merch, because of the data that streaming services have on their users.
And, yes, what they
and,
like and where
at
they
the
live.
Moment, as like the integration of ticketing services at the moment is, like I said before, like you go to an artist page and it says this artist is playing near you whenever, you know, this Friday. But there's more that could be done with that. I mean, you know, streaming services know where, you know, most people are listening to an artist. They can provide data that would really help with booking tours, because they could tell artists where their fans are.
And also,
and some artists have used that data or attempted to use that data to book tours. But there's so much more could be done with that. And then pushing tickets to people, in rather than just hoping that someone will land on the artist page and notice that they're playing near them soon, they could be sending them, you know, notifications saying this artist who you listen to 400 times a week is playing in your town soon.
And I think for live, being able to do really targeted communication, because if you've got a gig where ticket sales are slow, and obviously it's you can see that and you can see the gig coming close, you don't want to put out a big announcement to everybody, oh, we're knocking £5 off the ticket price. You don't want to admit to the world that your ticket sales aren't going very well. But if you can email people specifically and you can say, and also if you're selling tickets through Ticketfly, you will know they live in the right city, they're a fan, but we know they haven't bought a ticket because everything's joined up. So we can go to them and give them the £5 off as if it's a very special thing just for them without having to admit to the world that we're not selling any tickets and therefore start to fill up. And it's interesting that the Songkick guys, who obviously, you know, through their service, both as a data service and the ticket selling that they've added on top, they've looked at this a lot. And I mean, they do always argue that a lot of artists have capacity. I mean, actually, most artists aren't selling out when they tour, you know, except at a very top level. But often there will be a chunk of fans in every town where they play who would go to the gig. They just don't realise it's on. And as you say, they don't click on the artist page and they don't click on the Facebook page. And often only when they read the reviews or they see the tweets after the event that they go, oh, my God, that band was playing. So there is huge potential here, assuming they get it right. I don't know if they will get it right. There are logistical issues around the different stakeholders. Promoters will have existing relationships with ticketing companies. They may not want to switch to Ticketfly, et cetera, et cetera. But game-changing, I don't know.
Because it's a step in the right direction,
potentially.
But that is not quite as snappy as saying it's a game changer for music.
It's an opportunity which Pandora and Ticketfly may not fuck up. I think that's what we can say. That's our summary. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this develops. But also, we know the other streaming platforms are also dabbling in this space. I mean, there was talk of YouTube doing more of this. That was a while ago now. But yeah. Arguably, services like YouTube and SoundCloud, which aren't bringing in as much revenue, a bit like Pandora, probably should be working on this all the more than, say, the Spotify's and the Deezer's of the world. So I think all of this joined-up thinking is going to increase in the coming years. But as is often the way, the technology is sort of there. The data crunching is there. It's now getting all the different stakeholders in the music industry, the label, the publisher, the promoter, the agent, the venue, all the people that the artist works with who often don't really talk to each other. It's getting all them more joined up. And as is always the way, that's usually where these things fall down. But well done for changing the game.
Yeah. Next, it's been quite the week in the courts for Australian indie label Modular.
It has two legal disputes that Modular has been having this year, one with Universal Music and one with BMG. And both of these cases have been rumbling around for quite a few months now, but there was resolution, one in the court and one out of the court.
Yes.
So should we deal with the Universal dispute first?
Yes. So I said Australian indie label there, which it is now and was before, but somewhere in the middle it was aligned with Universal.
That's right. So, I mean, they've had a partnership with Universal for a while, and that included Universal taking a 50% stake. And this dispute was over an agreement that was half negotiated, or as Universal would see it, completely negotiated last year, which was basically have seen Universal taking full ownership of this, which is quite common when an indie label operates completely independently for a number of years. Then what quite often happens is they form a distribution relationship with a major so that they get a major company to take over all the distribution stuff. Then as a result of that partnership, the major might then take an equity stake in the indie. And it's quite common, ultimately, for the major to then take complete ownership of the indie, which is what Universal was seeking to do last year. But,
well, that deal would have seen the company's founder, Stephen Pavlovich, give up his stake in the company and also step down as its director, which ultimately he decided he didn't want to do.
Yes,
and so walked away from the deal.
Quite late last year, I don't know how long this deal had been negotiated for, but then quite late last year he decided that actually he didn't want to go through with this and he wanted to carry on, you know, working in partnership rather than sort of, you know, offloading the label onto Universal in its entirety. Universal didn't seem that keen on on that idea, and they insisted that a deal had been done. And although they admitted no signature had happened on a piece of paper, their argument was that there had been various email exchanges which constituted the deal being done. And I suppose it is worth saying that if agreements are reached over email, then that can be a binding contract. You know, you don't need to have a signature on the bottom of a piece of paper. Agreements can occur through an email chain. And I suppose proof that Universal weren't utterly trying this on and that there was some case for them to be had came in the fact that when this first went to court earlier in the year, Universal did win.
Yeah, it went to the Supreme Court of New South Wales, which ruled in Universal's favour. So that sorted then. Universal can happily take ownership of Modular.
And take all the artists on and the roster on, but...
Well, Stephen Pavlovich went and appealed, didn't he? He went and took it to the appeal court, and the appeal court this week said, yeah, all right, there's no deal done. Emails do not constitute a deal. The judge actually said, whichever way the matter is looked at, I do not think that a binding agreement was reached.
I think one of the areas of dispute was there was an email where either he or his lawyer said he was going to sign the document, but then he didn't. And so the debate was, well, he's saying that you're going to sign the document, actually a binding agreement. And they say, on appeal, the judge was saying, no, that doesn't... Just saying that you're going to sign the agreement doesn't mean I'm signing the agreement. So they sided with Stephen on that one, and he put out a press release. He seemed to be quite happy about this.
He said that he was relieved and basically said that, you know, glad this is all behind them. Really hope that me and Universal can be friends one day because I've always had so much respect for that company. And great bunch of guys.
Particularly the sort of the Australian division of the business. So yes, he was trying to be, although he was saying, yaha, I won, and he was positioning it as a David and Goliath case, you know, the big bad major record company tried to screw me over and they won at first instance, but I kept on fighting and we've won. Oh, but Universal, you were lovely. We enjoyed working together. And because I mean, I'm not quite sure, in theory, it's not that he's got the other 50% back. In theory, it's still a 50-50 JV. So there are still some issues to be resolved. And as far as Universal are concerned, there's a lot of issues still to be resolved.
So he was just like, hey, let's just all be friends again now, put this all behind us. And Universal put out a statement to Billboard where it basically just said, fuck that. We're going to take this to a higher court and we're going to win this time.
Yeah, so they're going to go to Supreme Court at the Australian level rather than at the... are they states in Australia? What do they call the
well
bits
be.
Of Australia? That's something I really should know. Let's call it a state.
Yeah.
And if it's wrong, we apologise to anybody listening in Australia. So yes, as far as Universal are concerned, this case is not as yet resolved. And it does feel like Modular has been a little bit in limbo while all of this has been rumbling on. So, which is a shame because, I mean, it is worth mentioning, it's a great label with a great heritage. And I think a lot of people will know Modular. And it is one of those labels that has a reputation outside the industry. It's not just people who work in the industry know it because they know most indie labels. It's like Ninja. It's like Warp. It had a good reputation. And a few years ago, it was one of those labels that just kept to keep signing, you know, artist after artist that were A, really good, and B, went on to do
good stuff. Was a period when lots of Australian acts sort of broke out of Australia, got an international platform, and they got some international recognition. And quite often you would find that it was because they were working with Modular, and Modular just had a really good track record for finding these artists.
And those artists included Tame Impala?
Yes, which brings us on to part two of our story. Because as we mentioned, there were two legal wins, or, well, legal...
Developments. Positive developments.
The other one, as you said, was a case brought by BMG. BMG said that Modular hadn't paid the mechanical royalties on a Tame Impala album.
Yes.
And therefore went legal. Said that Modular owed $450,000.
So Tame Impala was signed to Modular but published by BMG.
Yeah.
So obviously what that means is whenever Modular puts out records of Tame Impala, they then have to pay a royalty to the owners of the copyright in the song, because Modular only own the copyright in the recording. So we call that mechanical rights. And depending on which country you're in, it's always done through the collective licensing system, but it varies slightly. And certainly in terms of the statement that was put out by Modular this week, this dispute Well, they were sort of spinning it as a communication error, weren't they?
Yeah.
But this dispute was related to the American mechanicals on various Tame Impala releases in recent years. And the allegation was that they had got a license, but they then hadn't paid the royalties. And when BMG went legal on this earlier in the year, they sued both Modular and Universal because, as we've just discussed, the two have been in business for some time. Universal then really distanced themselves from it and said, oh, no, this is nothing to do with the Modular company where we're a business partner. That's not involved here. It's another Modular company where we're not involved. So yeah. They were sort of pushing it over onto the other side.
Yeah, but the statement from Modular this week was that, yeah, this is all a bit of a misunderstanding. It shouldn't have gone as far as it did. We've sorted it all out now and it's all settled, done and dusted. That's all fine. We've heard on the grapevine that there's a bit more to it than that. But, you know, the case has been settled.
Yes. So seemingly agreements have been reached behind the scenes and the case is therefore going to be dismissed. That case was in the American courts rather than the Australian courts. In the statement, he also had a little dig at the media coverage of this dispute and saying that it had been misrepresented, i.e. had been reported that he was not only ripping off BMG, but actually he was ripping off his band because ultimately BMG were collecting monies on behalf of the artist. Although part of that did come from Tame Impala themselves.
Yeah.
Was it a Reddit Ask Me Anything? There was something that they did where they discussed the fact that they hadn't been paid their mechanicals.
Yeah, so it wasn't all our fault in the media. We can't take the blame for everything.
Yeah. Stop dissing us journalists. But anyway,
we'll put out a statement.
Yes.
We've been misrepresented.
Yes,
Modular Records.
Let's get our press release out there. But anyway, at the end of the press release, he said that he wanted to draw a line under this. He hasn't drawn a line under the Universal bit, although to be fair, I think he meant drawing a line under the BMG Tame Impala dispute.
Yeah, let's all be friends.
So I assume that line has been drawn, but as I say, we've only heard it from his side properly, so who knows? But as far as we can see, a good week for Modular Recordings and their lawyers.
Good old lawyers.
Also on the tweets this week,
yeah,
someone suggested that we should play clips of the tracks that we approve, which in the ideal world we would do.
Yes.
But in order to have the clips, we would need a license to cover both the recording rights and the publishing rights. And while there are plenty of podcasts out there who have little sneaky bits of music in their podcast, and we suspect, and in some cases we know, they don't have the licenses that they require from the record industry and the publishing industry. We don't think we could get away with it.
No, because we discuss licensing in quite a lot of detail, quite a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty much all we seem to talk about. So it would be very hard for us to then turn around and say, oh, we didn't know that we needed a license to put music in the podcast.
But the fact
we could hum.
PRS, we could get a license from PRS for the songs.
We could.
But PPL do not do a similar license.
They don't.
So we'd have to do direct deals with all the labels, and we just don't have time for that.
We should stress that that's not PPL's fault, that's the label's fault, because the labels won't let PPL license podcasts. But anyway, we wouldn't pay them anyways, because we're cheapskates. So so even if there was a license, we wouldn't be spending money on
but
it.
But you can go and listen to all of these songs on our website.
You can.
And if you go to the page for this specific podcast, they're all the approved columns are linked.
They're all linked.
So it's just the work of a moment to go and listen to these.
So what you could do is you could pause the podcast, go and listen to the track, and then listen, come
back. I think you should listen after I've described it.
Okay, so you're going
to don't listen to them in advance. Or there's no point in me talking about them.
Right.
They've
right.
got to pick.
Well, they could see
of these four, they've got to choose which ones they want to listen to. It might be all four. I would hope all four, but maybe just one.
Interesting. Okay.
That's how reviews work, isn't it?
So I was going to suggest that you could hum them, but you're thinking this is a better solution.
Well, I could hum them, but we'd have to get that PRS license, wouldn't we?
Actually, technically, we would. You're right. Unless you hummed them really badly, which I suspect you would. So we'd probably be all right. Julia Kent, why did you approve Julia Kent?
I approved Julia Kent for the same reason I approved all of these artists, which is that I like her music.
But is that all you're going to say?
I don't think
them?
That's enough to fill this slot. Julia Kent is a cellist. She is a former member of Rasputina, member of Anthony and the Johnsons. She is also about to release her fourth solo album, which is called Asperity. Which is a record themed on difficulty and adversity. So that sounds like fun. In fact, it is the track that I picked, Invitation to the Voyage, is quite calming, although it's a moment of calm within an album that has many different textures to it.
Western. I'm assuming that's how we're saying this.
Western, yeah. That's how. I mean, you could say Western, but I think Western's probably easier.
No vowels, basically.
Now, this one feels almost like a cheat, because I'm pretty sure that the next week this track will be a hit in the charts, which we don't normally pick tracks quite so surefire hits.
Andy doesn't normally pick songs that other people will like, but this week, in a break
this one,
from
this
the norm,
one you might like. This is it's a track called Into by this West London R&B trio. This track has been something of a hit over the summer, but then they signed to Atlantic in August, and now this track is being rush released, even though it really should have been released as a summer hit, because that's what it basically sounds like.
If only they got out last week, because last week we had a bit of an Indian summer.
Yeah, well, it's too late now, but late I think now. It's good enough that it will probably still be hanging around.
It'll be a Halloween
next
hit.
Yeah. And it's basically, I mean, it's sort of, their sound is sort of a take on the kind of mainstream sounds of R&B and hip hop that are coming out of the States at the moment, like, I don't know, Young Thug and Fetty Wap, people like that. But it has more of a, it has a very British take on it, particularly obviously in the vocals, because they've got British accents. And it's a really good track. It's just a good pop track.
So check it out, or just listen to the chart, because Andy Malt's prediction is it'll be on the chart. It's on a Friday afternoon now, isn't it, the chart?
Yeah.
Who presents it? It's no longer Bruno Brooks.
It's Greg James, isn't it? Because it's part of his show.
It is.
It's not even his own show anymore.
It's part of Drive Time on Friday.
Which is, you know, I think we noted that when they changed it, that, you know, people weren't really listening to the Sunday chart anymore, so it's now in a show that people might listen to. Though obviously neither of us do.
Neither of us, because
we're busy on
really
a Friday.
Remember it. Anyway, why are we talking about the chart? Why aren't you talking about 2001?
Good point, because I don't think this song is going to bother the charts, even though it is a very good pop song. But
too good for the charts.
Too good for the charts. Yeah, Greg James wouldn't touch this. 2001 is a new project from Joan Wasser, who you might know as Jonas Policewoman.
I do.
Yeah.
That is how I know her.
Actually, unusually for music, you do know who she is. I've seen her CDs on your desk. And Benjamin Lazar Davis.
Because I know someone who works at a label. But
don't give that away.
But I knew her music before that.
Oh yeah, right. Well, she was approved long ago.
Yeah, exactly. And I listened to everything you approved, so that's how I knew.
Don't. Anyway, Joan Wasser and Benjamin Lazar Davis are 2001. This is a duo. They got together after they met somewhere and they were chatting about how they'd both been to Africa to make music. Joan Wasser as part of Damon Albarn's Africa Express. And then Ben Davis had studied over there, studying, I think, traditional West African music, which you wouldn't think has a place in pop, perhaps. But it does, because they've done it with this. Their track is called Broke Me In Two. It's their first track from an album of pop music influenced by traditional African music. And as we had a quote from Joan Wasser.
We had quite a few quotes, if I remember
rightly. Yeah, she basically said, you could listen to it with it in mind that this is all based on traditional West African music, or you could just enjoy it as a pop song. It works both ways.
So take your choice. Is that an expression?
No.
Get your gun.
Get your, you threw me for a second there. Get Your Gun is the next artist. It's not a weird turn of phrase that means take your choice. Get Your Gun, they're from Denmark. They are a duo of brothers. They make kind of slow, dark blues punk. And they've got their debut album coming out called The Worrying Kind. I'm not sure if it's The Worrying Kind of album or The Worrying Kind of music. Maybe you have to listen to the album to find out. They've got a track out called Black Book, which is a very, very good song that I recommend listening to. It's a thick atmosphere. It's punchy. It's dark, as I mentioned. It's slow. They make a big point of being slow. They said there's another band we've got a quote where they said that because they come from a small town, they play slowly. Not sure how that works, but apparently that's the case. And they're very good.
So go check all of those out, completemusicupdate.com/approved. And at the top of the list, you'll see all the things we've just talked about. You can click on them, read more, listen to the tracks, or watch the videos if he happens to have posted a video.
Well, you can listen to the tracks and watch the videos.
Well, you can do both at the same time.
I mean, you could mute it.
Yeah, multitask. And we will now insert a 3-second gap so you can pause while you go and do that. And then we'll end. You'll know the gap's over because the sort of the jingle will kick in. So I enjoyed listening to those approved there. That was fun. I'm trying. Well, which was my favourite? I reckon my favourite was 2001. Because I listened to all of them, as I hope all of our listeners did, because you really should. And I'm giving 2001 my vote, so they can put that on something. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that new little thing we're doing there in the middle of the podcast.
What, people pausing?
People pausing, listening to some music. Have a coffee, because I've still got some coffee and it's going cold. I should have drunk it while I was listening to the tracks. If I'd actually listened to the tracks, I could have done that. As it is, I'm going to drink this coffee while you get on with the next bloody story.
Yeah, fucking hell! It's Pandora again.
That's what we're talking about today.
That's three inappropriate swears now,
is
by
it?
The way. I think we need two more.
Still. Two more to get to the five. We're assuming that other people find it amusing.
Of course they do.
Other people might not be 12. But anyway, yeah, why are we talking about Pandora again?
Because this is not so much about Pandora. Pandora is an aside to this. Somewhat. We're talking about the US Copyright Royalty Board. God, that sounds like fun.
Well, we've already mentioned them. They're getting a second name check edition of the podcast. I mentioned, didn't I? I remember. I definitely mentioned how the Copyright Royalty Board is currently reviewing the rates that Pandora pay and that Pandora wants to get them down and the labels want to get them up. That's something that is happening in America right now as we speak.
Yeah, it has been happening for some time now.
It is happening right now. So this is the compulsory license I mentioned. So
yes.
The services in America that are licensed through Sound Exchange. So Sound Exchange is a collecting society, in essence. It administers the compulsory license. So it's basically online radio services. So that includes more conventional online radio stations, which play music, and personalised radio services like Pandora. Because they're licensed through Sound Exchange, everybody pays statutory rates, and this thing called the Copyright Royalty Board sets the statutory rates, and they've been thinking very hard and very long about what rates should happen as of next year. So all the rates could change next year, and they're trying to decide whether they should go up or down or sideways or who knows what.
Yes, Pandora would like down. Labels would like up. Well, actually, labels would like take back the rights and do the direct deals themselves.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
Yeah.
So but stick with it.
But that's not what we're talking about today. What we're talking about today is that it emerged that the Copyright Royalty Board had gone to the US Copyright Office and raised some questions, one of which was, could we set different rates for different groups of copyright owners?
Yes. So the Copyright Royalty Board, which are judges... And apparently the judges considering this are relatively new to the job. And so they have gone to the US Copyright Office, which oversees all of this stuff, to ask some questions. And the question, it turns out, they actually asked it a few weeks ago, but it only really became public knowledge in the last week. As you say, is they're saying, well, as it normally works under Sound Exchange and pretty much every other collective licensing system in the world, is that everybody gets paid the same. That's almost one of the sort of the ethos of collective
licensing.
That's
kind of the rule.
Is so, over here in the UK, when music gets played on the radio station has to pay some money to PPL and to PRS in order to play the music, the people we're not willing to pay, which is why we can't play music on the podcast. But so Radio 1 pays some money to PPL and some money to PRS, and it doesn't matter whether or not it is big pop star, so if it's Taylor Swift, or if it's Justin Bieber, or if it's, hang on a second, who are you approving this week? Or if it's Get Your Gun.
Yeah.
If they get daytime airplay on Radio 1, they all earn the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the general principle of collective licensing, and it applies to Sound Exchange too. But what the judges were saying was, could we have one set of rates for one group of people, and another set of rates for another group of people?
Yeah, they didn't say who those groups were. However, people have generally thought that probably means major labels and independent labels.
Yes. So could we give major labels we assume the proposal would be that they would give the major labels a better rate than the indie labels. So although they've not been that explicit, that is what everybody assumes. This question was asked a few weeks ago. All stakeholders who've been submitting their opinions to this review were then invited to give specific opinions about this proposal. The deadline for that was last week. Everybody put their input in. And now this one person at the Copyright Office who is called...
Maria Palant.
So she now has to A, look at everybody's submissions, B, review the law for herself and work out whether or not this would be allowed. And as far as we're aware, this, I think, is gossip via billboard. But both Sony and Universal apparently have submitted... Well, the word was a joint submission in which they said, perhaps that is something that you should...
Guys, that sounds like a good idea.
And people are saying it's not that Sony and Universal are going in and saying, yeah, that's a good idea, you pay us double. But that the majors are thinking, now, if they were to say no, there can be no variation, that rule could then be set in stone forever. And so they basically want to keep their options open. So it's not necessarily that they're going to push for higher rates than the indies and everyone else in this review, but they would like to have that flexibility moving forward. And I suppose, you know, it's worth saying that where streaming services negotiate directly with record companies, so Spotify can't operate under a sound exchange license. It's not eligible for that sort of license in America. So Spotify have to go to all the labels and negotiate deals directly. And as a general rule, the bigger rights owners often do get slightly better rates than the smaller rights owners. Those rates are all secret, so we don't actually know. But I think, you know, it can be 1%, it can be 0.5%, it can be slight differences, although bearing in mind the number of streams that are happening, it can actually add up to quite significant sums of money. So the ideas of different rights owners, majors versus indies, getting different rates does happen when you are direct licensing. But it doesn't usually happen in collective licensing. So this is where there would be an innovation if the Copyright Office said to the Copyright Royalty Board that they could have some sort of variation on the sound exchange system.
Yes. So, as you said, Sony Universal, open to the idea. The American Association of Independent Music, A2IM, as it is known, less keen.
Unsurprisingly.
Put out a statement last week saying that independent record labels and artists who are individuals and small and medium-sized businesses want a competitive market that places all sound recording owners and their artists on a level playing field. Statutory price differentiation based on category of licenses would not lead to such a competitive market. Rather, it would create a number of unintended and expensive issues for all market participants, especially when there is no market remedy available to any licensor who is not granted a top rate.
There is the issue that if they did decide to allow variation in the sound exchange rates, A, that would, I think, be quite controversial. But beyond that, it then throws up all sorts of questions, which I'm not sure the Copyright Royalty Board wants to have to answer, which is, A, how do you define a major record company? Because we all know that Sony, Warner and Universal are the major record companies, but how do you put it in a sort of, you know, a legislation or you know, statutory documents that says these are the major record companies? You could do it on market share, because obviously Sony and Universal have much, much bigger market share than everyone else, and then Warner has quite significant market share, and the indies a lot less so. But then who defines market share? Because the industry at the moment defines market share.
Yeah.
But the indie labels already argue that the market share figures that the majors put out are unfair, because what Merlin, who represents the indies on quite a lot of the streaming deals, or a big chunk of the indies, I should say, what they argue is that when the majors go to the streaming services with their market shares, they do market shares for the whole record industry, not just streams. And once you take CDs out of the mix, and especially if you take CDs and downloads out of the mix, then often the indies market share goes up a bit. Mm. And so what Merlin says...
And this has been the case for quite... Yeah. For years.
Yeah, since we've seen the shift from CD to digital and obviously download to stream. And so Merlin say, you know, it's unfair that the way they work out the market shares is skewed to the major's advantage. And so therefore, if you start having a statutory license which is taking market share into account, then you probably then need to start having some sort of independent body working out what the market shares are. And I'm not sure that's a road anybody really wants to have to go down.
And on what premise would you say, like, I mean, say if you were saying, like, you know, majors deserve a higher cut because majors have the most valuable music, the most popular music. So, you know, Justin Bieber is a major label artist. His music is very popular. Well, we'll see. Well, actually, no, his new stuff is more popular. So his music is therefore more valuable than someone signed to a little indie label, and that's why they should get a higher rate. However, then you have artists like, I mean, in the US, Taylor Swift, who is signed to an independent label and is the biggest artist in the world right now. Are you saying, therefore, that her music is less valuable because she signed to an indie label?
And then you get into the complications that some indie labels, for example, Big Machine, that Taylor Swift is signed to in the US, work with majors. So they work with Universal on Taylor Swift.
Well, I suppose, the other example, I was thinking of Adele initially, but then I thought she isn't a bad example because actually in the US she is signed to a major.
Yes, well, or distributed through
a major. Distributed through a major.
So you know, even artists who are signed to indie labels are sometimes distributed by majors or by companies like The Orchard, which is owned by a major. So I just think that if they go down this route, there are just so many tricky questions to answer, which really nobody wants to have
they
to
haven't
answer.
Really thought this through.
So we'll see. We'll see, A, what the US Copyright Office says, and then if the US Copyright Office does give some flexibility here, whether or not the Copyright Royalty Board judges decide to use that power.
Just time now before we get to our final story to look through a few of the other things that have happened this week that we don't have time to properly discuss. But the first one here, I think, might come up again in the future. Nearly 100 ex-Blinkbox employees have brought a class action lawsuit against Guvera through the UK Employment Tribunal over the closure of the service in June.
Not much time to talk about this, but remember, Blinkbox was Tesco's digital content service. It then decided to sell it off at the end of last year. It sold the music bit to Guvera, which is this Australian streaming service. We were told that this was Guvera entering the UK market, all very exciting, blah, blah, blah.
6 months later, shut it down.
Then they shut it down and they put it into administration. And that seemed a bit odd at the time. And it was up for sale. I assume nobody bought it because I assume we would have been told if someone had bought it. Why would they buy it? And then, out of the blue, I think behind the scenes this has been brewing for a while, but then officially it was announced today as we record this podcast that this law firm representing all of the employees who were, when Guvera bought it, they were given reassurances, weren't there, that if there was going to be any downsizing, there would be a proper redundancy system. And then it seems out of the blue, they just said, bye.
Yes, here. We're not supposed to be discussing this in detail.
But, no.
But anyway, it's an interesting story. Well, it's worth spending another 30 seconds on.
The thing is the lawyer who is representing these guys also predicted that there is some other fallout to come from the shutdown of Blinkbox too. So I suspect we'll be coming back to this.
Well, yeah, no, as I said, I think we will. And it was quite damning. It was, just a press release that went out today announcing that they were launching this lawsuit, but quite damning saying that basically in the space of, less than 6 months between when Guvera took ownership of it and shut it down, they took it from profit to debt in about 5 months' time.
That's the allegation,
allegation.
Guvera are yet to respond to this.
That's for the courts to decide.
Or technically the Employment Tribunal.
Yeah.
Hey, what else?
Sony is considering selling Sony ATV, or at least part of it.
Yes, so Sony's publishing company, it's a joint venture with the Michael Jackson estate, biggest music publisher in the world, because Sony ATV, as well as being a massive publisher in its own right, also then controls EMI Music Publishing, although there are other shareholders involved. Rumour has it Sony is exercising a clause to discuss with the Michael Jackson estate either selling off its half to the estate or to somebody else, who knows what. Nothing might come of this. It's a thing that's happening.
It seems like it might. There's a clause in their contract that just triggers this. They sort of technically have to have this discussion. So it might just be that they're going through the motions and nothing will come of it. Or it might be that, they sell it off. Sony ATV is valued at $2 billion.
I mean, interestingly, in all those Sony emails that leaked late last year, there were a few emails through some people quite high up in Sony in the US who had been saying, perhaps we should sell Sony ATV. It has a complicated ownership structure, Sony ATV, and I think that's one of the things that they're like, that's all a bit messy. Perhaps we should just get out of that and focus on Sony Music, our record company. But anyway, we will see.
We will see. We've just spent too long on the first
stories,
so we're going to have to really fly through these. Deadmau5 has ditched Universal in favour of Cobalt.
He has.
That's basically all you need to know. Phil Rudd, ex-AC/DC drummer, has lost an appeal on the sentence he received for threatening to kill and drug possession.
He did.
HMV is planning to expand its website into other countries. Benga has called for better discussion of mental health.
It seems wrong to to write that off we with should... a flippant yeah. So perhaps we should come back to that topic properly one day, because it's a bit basically Google Benger talking about his own experiences with mental health
yeah,
issues.
Yeah, there's a very good interview in The Guardian. Yeah. But I think this is something that's going to become more of an issue in the next year. So,
and I think what he's saying generally is interesting, but also in the context of working within the music industry.
Yes.
So go read all of those good articles.
Lastly on this list, Busted reuniting Charlie and all.
Definitely
happening.
That's the rumour this week. Charlie fucking Simpson is rejoining Busted, even though he was kind of like a Morrissey. Never going to do it. Never going back to that bloody band.
Oh, look how much money they earned. Yeah, look how they did with Busted.
Yeah, how well McBusted went. Perhaps I'll get in there. Is the rumour. It may all be confirmed by the time this podcast comes out. Who knows?
And finally, let's discuss George Osborne.
It was the Conservative Party conference this week.
George Osborne, you might have noticed, not a music industry figure.
No.
Barely a figure at all.
But the Tories have been in the news this week with their... most of the speech... I mean, I didn't watch any of the speeches at the Tory Party conference, but from the coverage I've watched of them, they're sort of amusing, providing you don't take them seriously. A bit like the Justin Bieber interview we had last week. But this was an interview George Osborne gave... Was it at the conference or before
no,
the conference?
No, well, this is the
Daily... Part one was before, part two was at the conference.
Well, yes, so the Daily Mail did a profile of George Osborne.
An infographic?
Well, no, they did a whole profile. There was a whole article. The infographic was at the end.
Right. But I only read the infographic.
Well, I read the whole lot.
Well, well done you.
Thanks. Presumably they did this because George Osborne is being lined up as the next leader of the Conservative Party as soon as they can get... David Cameron out. If they just mention him doing things to dead pigs a few more times, maybe that will happen. But yeah, there's this interest in George Osborne at the moment because he's at least thought to be the guy they're lining up to take over next, which seems like a crazy idea.
Well,
but anyway,
he's not Boris.
I suppose when the options are George Osborne and Boris, yeah, it's less of a tricky choice. Anyway,
The incoming world of Donald Trump and Boris Johnson being the two of the world leaders. Anyway, sorry, I'm digressing. We're thinking of a mad future world coming.
This is supposed to be a light-hearted end to the podcast. Let's not bring it down.
with future terrible predictions. Tell us about George Osborne and NWA.
Basically, so the Daily Mail did this profile, and right at the end, it did, for reasons who knows, did this sort of infographic of George Osborne's cultural top five.
Well, I think they were trying to make him seem more human, because he's not a politician who comes across as being especially human.
No. And so, yeah, it was always top five stuff. And then, like, right at the bottom, it was like George Osborne's top five gigs. Top of the list was NWA at Brixton Academy, which is a gig he attended in 1991 as a student.
Now, obviously...
But that was it. That was like, there you go, there's that information. Probably don't need any context.
Andy, being a very prejudiced person, thought that that didn't sound right, that someone like George Osborne...
I didn't think it didn't sound right.
...posh white kid could possibly be interested in edgy, groundbreaking
rap. I don't think I ever said that.
That was what you thought, though.
No, it's not. So, I thought that's fine. I thought... I found... The fact that he went... In fact, there was all kinds of things in there. The fact that he'd been to an NWA gig, he really liked the Young Ones. The opening of Trainspotting was one of his favourite film
basically,
moments.
Basically, you and him are the same person.
Well, there was all these things that then make you think, how have you come up with these policies if these are your favourite things? And the only thing is, like, I've got two theories. One, he is being forced against his will to put these policies forward. Which is quite possible, because he always seems to struggle to actually explain what is in them, even though he's apparently written them. Or two, he thinks that all these things he's seen in TV, films and music are incredible flights of fancy that could never happen in real life. And so it doesn't matter that he's cutting tax credits and stuff, because it doesn't affect any real people, only imaginary people who he sees at the Brixton Academy.
But the good news is, you having been a little bit confused about this NWA gig, so was someone at The Guardian. So although the Daily Mail just had it as a little fact in passing, then The Guardian dug further.
Yes, well, there was a Q&A at the Conservative Party conference with George Osborne and The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner. And she rightly dug into this. And then, as I said, right, you get him on Radio 4 to talk about his policies, and he really struggles to explain anything about them. doesn't seem to have any idea what's going on at all. And then he spoke really eloquently about this NWA gig, which just, I think, further fans my theory that...
He's just being forced.
He's being forced.
He's actually a lefty hip-hop fan.
Yeah, but he's done something to a pig and someone knows about it.
And so now he has to pretend to be an evil Tory.
Yeah, so he basically said it was an amazing concert. These were the angriest young band from America, and it's definitely the coolest thing I ever did. It's not like a pattern of going to all the latest concerts. I just happened to hit lucky and go to this band who were only together for a couple of years. And then he talked about it being raw and angry, and he may not have kind of condoned the things they were saying, but it was very exciting, and he was glad that, you know, it was something that he saw. He didn't realise that they'd become such a big cultural phenomenon. Although by the time they got to play in Brixton Academy, surely they were already a cultural phenomenon.
And then he waffled on about Dre and Beats a bit.
Yeah, he waffled on about how in 2012 he had Dr. Dre round to Downing Street to chat about his headphones business. And then he talked about how, you know, he was this kind of guy who came from a difficult background who then worked up to run a massive headphone business that he sold to Apple, which I guess sort of does go back to more Tory policies.
Yes, back to the sort of free market,
maybe it's not
capitalism, making lots of money. You know how I did the podcast that one week from Holmes Chapel, home of Harry Styles?
I remember.
Well, George Osborne is MP for the neighbouring constituency.
Oh, yeah.
And a few years ago...
Did he work in a bakery?
I don't think he comes from there. He's one of those, it's a really safe Tory seat.
No, but has he ever worked in a bakery while being an MP?
I do not know. I don't know about George Osborne's baking experience. But one year, the Knutsford, which is a town in his constituency, were having their Christmas lights turned on. And the rumour went round that Harry Styles was going to do it, which wasn't, you know, a ridiculous suggestion because Harry Styles comes from Holmes Chapel, which is just down the road from Knutsford. So the rumour went round that Harry Styles was going to be there to turn on the lights. And so all of the teenage girls from that part of Cheshire were all there. And then it was George Osborne turning. And it had never been Harry Styles. It was just a local MP. And so there was George Osborne. So perhaps he did a little NWA rap to not seem so out of place to all of those One Direction fans.
Would that be something that would placate One Direction fans?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not. What else was he into? Everything else he was into was quite credible too, wasn't
it? Sufjan Stevens, St. Yeah. Vincent.
Yeah, none of that stuff would probably be of interest to One Direction fans.
No.
So there you go. I mean, that's all we've got to say about George Osborne.
Probably is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's tie this whole thing up then.
Yeah.
Why don't you let us know the most depressing interest you share with a politician? You can tweet us at CMU or leave us a message on Facebook, Complete Music Update. And if you can't bring yourself to think about that, just leave us a 5-star review on Amazon. It's just, you know, a thought I'm putting out there. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. For more on CMU, go to CompleteMusicUpdate.com.
I'm going to say one more thing before we finish.
What?
Maybe put the 5 out of 5 review on iTunes and not Amazon. Just a thought.
Did I say Amazon?
To finish
Why did
off
I say Amazon?
This edition of the CMU podcast. See you next week.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Here, as always, and as always, the business editor of CMU.
Are you getting anything for your headphones? I can now.
Someone had pressed a button. I'm Andy Malt, the editor. I'll turn them down again.